This is ILTA Radio, the source for legal technology practices and ideas to help your career delivered to fit your busy schedule. ILTA Radio, get tuned in.
Hello, everyone. This is a ILTA recording on e-discovery mergers. The legal tech news lately has been full of reports on a number of e-discovery mergers and acquisitions. To name just a few of the largest, Epic being purchased by DTI Investors, Clearwell was acquired by Symantec, Quivio by Microsoft, Content Analyst by Kaikira, Recommind by OpenText, Lighthouse and Discovia merging. Today we'll explore how firms and clients may be affected and how you can prepare your teams for these events. The format will be to interview a panel who will share their insight, lessons learned, and best practices for dealing with e-discovery mergers in two regards. The first, product acquisitions, where one of your core applications is acquired by another enterprise software provider. You might encounter two scenarios. The product was acquired and is still available, or the product was acquired and abandoned. The second will be a discussion of the merger and acquisitions of service providers, where one provider is acquired by another. Let's introduce our panel. Today we have Dara Nevin, who is the Director of eDiscovery at Proskauer Rose LLP in New York. We have Dwayne Leith, who's the Director of Litigation Support at Jackson Walker LLP in Dallas. Bonnie Boudreau, who is the Practice Support Coordinator at Jones Walker LLP in New Orleans. And Deanna Blomquist, Senior Manager, IT and eDiscovery at Dish Network in Denver. My name is Catherine McPherson. I'm the ILTA Denver Member Liaison, and I'm a Litigation Management Consultant at Bartlett Beck here in Denver. So let's get started. Dwayne, let's have you start off. Could you describe the product acquisition experience at your shop?
Sure. Thanks, Catherine. We've had, during my tenure here at Jackson Walker, we've had a number of product acquisitions that we used within our firm. And, you know, we've probably some of the bigger ones was, the Clearwell acquisition. We've also was a big user of LiveNote. We've also used Law, and we even used Wave Technologies. And those were just some of the products that we've had experience with. As far as the impact to the firm, each one had kind of a separate way that we had to deal with it, primarily because of how the products were being positioned after the acquisition and how we wanted to continue to use them. In some cases, they were purchased and somewhat neglected. In some cases, they were abandoned, and in some cases, you could see that they were still supporting the product, but not very many enhancements were being made. So as far as how that impacted us overall is, we had to make some decisions on how we were going to move going forward with each one of those products. And in several cases, we opted to retire one of the products. In two other instances, we continued to use the products, but we replaced one of them. And then in one case, we phased that product out. So all four of those products were eventually removed from our core product list, but in the way that we handled it. So as far as the impact, overall to the firm and what we did, we had some definite things that we'll talk about a little bit more of how to handle that. At the time, we really didn't have a real good protocol in place for dealing with mergers and acquisitions, but since that's changed significantly in how we approach our products.
Great. Dara, did you have any thing to add to that?
I don't. I've had similar experiences to Dwayne, particularly where products have been abandoned over time. And so I've developed some strategies for dealing with
them. Great. We'll get into some of those in a little bit. So let's move to what steps you may have taken in anticipation of the acquisition. Did your vendor provide you with adequate notice of all aspects? I'm going to start with Duane on this one.
In almost all of the situations that we experienced, we were not really given much notice. We found out in a couple of instances it was just through the news publications or word of mouth or the rumor mill that may have been going on. So, you know, unfortunately, I think from a customer standpoint, we're not always the first call when things like this happen, mainly because it shouldn't be that way, but that's just the way it works. But one of the things that we have tried to put in place now to try to protect us a little bit from that is what I call more of an acquisition, you know, preparedness, where we try to keep track of what's going on in the industry, either through utilization of alerts. We try to make sure that, you know, our products, we keep a closer eye on the industry, you know, just through publications and what's going on through, you know, on the street, networking around with the individuals. So you kind of want to stay in front of it. It's not something that is not going to happen. It is going to happen. There is going to be products that are going to get acquired, and you just have to position yourself to have a plan in place. So when that does happen, make sure that when you're looking at certain products that you vet those products, but also have an exit strategy. So if you do have to move to another platform, you have an easy way to migrate your information over. So that's kind of been our experience is we know it's a known fact that at some point it may happen, but you just have to be prepared, you know, with a strategy in place so you can minimize the disruption within the firm if you have to go a different direction or make a change.
I'd like to add to that because, as Duane said, my experience is that customers are not always the first to know, and that makes sense. Often the acquisitions are confidential for a reason, and it's to protect the parties doing the deal. I've found, though, that even when you do things like monitor the core products, monitor the service levels, and you do all of this due diligence, you still might not have a sense of what's about to be acquired or who's about to merge. And so Duane's suggestion of having migration plans or other fallback plans is particularly important. It used to be that some of the weaker products were taken out by way of acquisition, but that is definitely not the case now. Acquisitions happen for a number of business reasons. And so having that alternative strategy for what you're doing with your product pool, either within your own organization or the product pool you're using with vendors, becomes very important.
Dara, was your data subject to migration to another platform in this acquisition?
You know, so that's a great question because when a product is discontinued and it's a strategic discontinuance, vendors can handle it in a number of different ways. Or you might decide that because of the elimination of the product, you might have a use case that is longer than the path set out by the new owner of that product. And so I have had to address circumstances where I did have to migrate, and there can be a very significant number of challenges. It can be more challenging to migrate from one platform to another than just to migrate to a new version of an existing platform. It's because data could be organized differently. It's because SQL backends could be differently. Imaging formats could be quite different from one platform to another. When I move from one tool and up to another, I find that the migrations do take longer. Because I've dealt with situations like that in the past, I now try to include in almost all of my contracts provisions about data migration if the product is discontinued for any reason, that there's a mandatory support provision, either requiring migration at no cost or at moderate cost. And I also put into my contracts the requirement to keep us updated about critical paths for tools, so that it gives me that early warning that something might be on the horizon in terms of significant changes in the direction of the product.
So, yep. Duane, I was going to ask you, what do you do if you purchased a product, but then as a result of the merger and acquisition, that product is abandoned? What do you do to prepare for that?
Well, unfortunately, you know, I've had I've had a few experiences with that. And one of the lessons learned from that is to try to, you know, shorten up your subscription contracts. I think there was a time, and it's very appealing in a lot of cases to, from a price standpoint, to consider long-term, you know, software agreements, maybe 3 years, something like that. But, you know, the problem you get into is by locking into that, if you don't have a real good exit strategy, you're going to have to potentially ride that product out until the end. One way is to try to shorten those, even though you may pay a little bit more on an annual basis, but try to go to shorter software agreements, you know, as far as licensing. The other option to consider in something like that is, you know, obviously you went through a lengthy due diligence to choose that product. You might have, you know, some contract provisions that might protect you a little bit if something happens within the first 90 days or 180 days to where, you know, you have a fallback strategy to where you can say, well, you know, if this happens, you might go to the runner-up in the case that you were considering to have an out to where you could, you know, easily migrate to that platform. But, you know, I think one of the biggest things you need to consider is to try to not lock yourself into a long-term relationship, and then make sure that, you know, you have, you know, alternative options to where you can, if that's bringing the information in-house, if that's the way you're managing your software application, or if it's an outside provider. But you need to be able to easily consider migrating that or shortening up your license agreement, because I think one of the things you need to do is always evaluate, you know, the technology and the business value of these products on an annual basis, just to make sure that product is still doing what it needs to be doing to satisfy what your needs are from the firm standpoint.
I'll ask both you this question, and Daryl, maybe you can start off. What are the key questions that you would ask when you're looking at a new product? What are the due diligence steps you go through and conduct on the product and the company?
What I'm not going to talk about is the due diligence on the features and functionality of the product. I think a lot of people do that and do that very well. What people don't always do is that due diligence on the product lifecycle and the product. So that's what I'm going to focus on, and I'll amplify a lot of the things that Duane has already talked about. So it's a different approach to purchasing software than what some of us might be accustomed to. And I describe it as the difference between buying emotionally or based on relationships and based in buying in light of a total cost of ownership model, which might include some of the costs associated with an early migration. So a lot of the time people buy software on the assumption that it will be used for 5 or 7 or even 10 years. And that might not be realistic in this environment where e-discovery and litigation support technology is turning over on a more frequent basis. So some of the due diligence that I do is really understanding what the product development roadmap is. I ask for that. I look at how often product releases are made, and I look at the history of releases. And I look at whether or not the company is sticking to their development timetable. If they aren't, it could indicate problems with development, with cash flow, or even with an aggressive milestone, which might make them more vulnerable to acquisition. I also look at who the key people are in the company and whether or not those key people have a history of exits, so a history of selling their product. And I try and find out whether or not those key people are connected to venture capital or other private equity funders. If so, and the products are being financed in that manner, that might also suggest the desire for an exit. I often do LinkedIn research to try and discover those things. And I do a lot of internet research. I go to sites like Glassdoor and Above the Law to see what people who work at the company are saying about it and to try and get a sense of the turnover and what the turnover might be related to. And then I also try and look at what partnerships they have with other technologies to try and understand whether a related technology could be acquired that could impact the technology that I'm looking at. And then I also look for funding and understanding of funding and financial statements, what their cash flow is, are they seeking sources of funding, and if so, what kind, if there's a strong desire to bring in additional funding. It might mean that new funding sources have a different understanding about what the company and product should be doing. I always, though, approach all of these things understanding that it's inevitable that a company is going to get acquired, and then it's a question of on what terms, and is the product likely to take a different direction in its roadmap or abandoned? Obviously, I look for a product that might take a different direction in its roadmap rather than one that's going to be abandoned if I think I might have a use for that technology that could exceed the timetable after the acquisition.
Yeah, I was just going to add a couple of small notes on top of that is, you know, a key question to ask is, you know, once one of the things that you're going to need to want to consider is whatever product that you're going to or working or considering going to, you need to make sure you take the time and take a look at how to get data in and how to get data out of it. And make sure for your own insurance policy, if something happens at some point down the road and you've got to pull the data out and put it into another platform, that it's pretty straightforward, that you've covered all the bases. And I think Dara did a good job of outlining a lot of that earlier in our conversation about the types of things that are critical, but especially the work product. You know, there are a lot of things that can be different with an application and may not come across as clean as you'd want it to, but you need to test to make sure that you are able to do an import and export of information easily, and that you can, to whatever platform that you may need to be going to, that you get redactions and you have a way to QC it, that you can make sure that whatever gets migrated, that there's a way that you can go in and make sure all the designations that were marked, you can test the redactions, you can test not only the document count, but, you know, the file count, and there's ways to go through all that. So it's part of your migration strategy, and you should have that considered as just part of being aware that the product may get acquired at some point and that you might have to go to another application, but that's just something you need to put in part of your due diligence of checking the product out, but also check it out to where if you need to move, you've got an easy migration plan or strategy in place to move forward.
Great. Earlier in our conversation, Dara mentioned a few of the contractual considerations. Are there contractual provisions that you can request to protect yourself?
Yep, that's a great question. And I'm just going to start by talking about some contractual provisions that might address some of the concerns that Duane raised, because he's raised some really key ones. What happens if you do need to migrate? So what I look for is help during transition provisions, things that specify what we need or what help might occur during a migration, such as migration assistance or reimbursement if the products are discontinued. Some other things I try and put in, both for my own protection, but also to make it a little bit more difficult for companies to sell products and then abandon their customers, are change of control provisions, to set out what a change of control is and what protections might be in place for the customer upon a change of control, particularly some terms around product abandonment, and then also some key man provisions. So if there are core developers, I might try and insert provisions that require notification if some of those key personnel depart, because that might be an early indication that an acquisition is in the works.
Well, terrific. I think we should turn now to the second type of M&A that we're seeing, which is involving service providers, where one provider is acquired by another. Specifically, in two different scenarios you might be encountering. One is managed services relationships or preferred provider project by project. And Bonnie and Deanna are going to tackle this. Let's start with you, Bonnie. Your firm entered into a managed services agreement with a fairly young but fast-growing company in early 2013 that was then acquired by a much larger international company just 2 years later. Can you describe the original terms of that MSA?
Sure. Thanks, Catherine. Under our original MSA, we were requesting that the vendor provide and manage the infrastructure for our review platform, which is KCARA's Relativity. So under the contract, the vendor would do things like deploy software upgrades for us, maintain our servers, and provide just technical troubleshooting and assistance as needed. But our firm would maintain total control over the administration of the environment, which includes data loading, workspace setup, account setup, and that sort of thing. And then after about 2 years of this vendor providing the service, they were acquired by, like you said, a much larger international company. And then less than 2 years later, that company was again acquired by another. So we've actually done this twice.
And so what did you learn from this experience with regard to entering into an MSA?
I think the most important thing, takeaway that I would mention to everybody is make sure you've got a provision in your contract that outlines how an acquisition will affect the terms of the contract. The most important thing is to have that option to terminate the contract if that acquisition happens and things start to go south. You always want to make sure that you have an out, that you can exit that contract and find a new service provider to manage your environment. And one thing that I don't know that was really thought out fully at the beginning of all of this is how much time do you really need to get out of the contract? Somebody comes in and takes over this company, and you're not really sure at the outset how things are going to change. They may not change at all, and you may not need that out. But a lot of times, it takes some time for that takeover to kind of trickle down, and you start to see, you know, key people that you communicate with daily start to leave the company, or they're asked to leave. Different companies do things differently, and a lot of times it just takes time for you to see the full effects of that acquisition on your own day-to-day operations. 30 days is probably not long enough unless you just know on the outset, hey, if this company gets acquired, we're jumping ship and then we don't care who acquires it and how they do business. But a lot of times you may want to build in a good time frame to evaluate that new service provider. And also, it takes time to find a service provider that you're happy with. So if you do decide to jump ship, it might take you some time to figure out who else offers this type of service and, you know, evaluate their offerings, see what else is out there. And if you don't have that knowledge up front, it might take you some time to gather it. So just make sure that if you have an out, it's not limited to, say, 30 days or 60 days. You might want to build in, if you can, I'd say 6 months to fully evaluate what happens after that acquisition. Something else to keep in mind is that different service providers have different ideas about what managed services means. And a general contract may not be enough. You may want to be very detailed and even, I would suggest, attach an appendix of very specific things that you expect your service provider to do for you under the terms of that contract. This is helpful in an acquisition because you may be dealing with a new company who's brand new to the area of managed services and truly does not know what their customers may expect. And it can also provide some leverage. If you've got a gold star standard and the vendor that you've been doing business with is doing a great job for you, you want to be able to hold your new vendor to that same standard. So if you have it all clearly outlined in writing as part of your contract, you have something to point to say, hey, you know, this is what we've expected from the outset, this is what we've been getting, and this is what we expect to continue to receive from your company. One other point of consideration is when you purchase your software licenses. We've purchased our Relativity licenses directly from K-Cura, and there was some talk after we signed up for the managed services, well, why don't you guys just purchase your licenses through us instead of directly from the software company? It might be a little bit cheaper for you to do so. But we decided to keep those licenses directly from K-Cura, and that's given us, I think, two really beneficial things. Number one, we can contact K-Cura directly for tech support. We don't have to go through our managed services provider when something goes wrong. So we actually have two levels of support, and that's nice to have, and sometimes we've really relied on that. The second thing is, if your managed services provider is acquired and you do decide to jump ship, you own your licensing. You're agnostic, so you can take those licenses when you go, and it's just not quite as complicated, I think, if you've purchased your licenses from your managed services provider directly.
Great. Deanna, you engage in preferred providers on a project basis. Tell us about your scenario there and how it might be different from Bonnie's.
Thanks, Catherine. As you said, we engage providers in what would be considered a much more traditional hosted project model, where we send our data, we collect our data internally, and then we send it out to the provider. They provide the people, the process, and the technology to deliver the project all in a hosted solution, and we just direct the work that the provider is doing. And this is really quite different from Bonnie's scenario, where the provider hosts the technology, but Bonnie's internal team provides the people and the process in order to administer and deliver the lit support services that her team delivers. As far as the M&A goes, in my scenario, our preferred provider was a regional provider with a very, very strong local presence in Denver. And that regional provider was acquired by a large multinational firm. So that's the scenario that we were reacting to. And strictly from an M&A perspective, one of the key differences between engaging at a managed services level and engaging on a project-by-project basis is that we can always choose to use another provider for the next project relatively easily, where it's a lot more difficult for Bonnie and her company or any other organization that's in a managed services scenario to unwind from that infrastructure provider. That being said, that doesn't lessen the impact on the current projects with the current provider who is involved in the M&A. And for our impact, it was largely related to the integration or differences between the people and the processes for the two providers. We had different resources handling the work. We had data being processed in different facilities following different protocols. And in many respects, we experienced decreased responsiveness. For us, it was kind of a shift from being a very large fish in a small pond to being a medium-sized fish in the ocean. So that's a little bit of the difference that we experienced in our scenario.
So what did you learn from this experience regarding entering into an agreement? And did your primary service provider radically switch platforms?
So the first consideration, above all, is to always have more than one provider vetted and under contract. I can't stress that enough. Even if you primarily use one provider and have the other for specific types of projects in your litigation portfolio, or even if you just have a second one waiting in the wings, you always want to make sure that you have options. You don't have all your eggs in one basket, because the last thing you want to do is experience a merger or acquisition, not be happy with the services you're getting from the new provider, and then have to be scrambling to find an alternative, you know, right when the next big litigation matter is hitting. So you really always want to have more than one provider in your portfolio of providers. The second consideration that you want to have is to make sure that your contract allows for renegotiation of the contract itself in the event of a merger or acquisition. You want to be able to go back to the contract terms and renegotiate those with the new company, rather than just assuming that the existing contract is going to carry over into the new arrangement and new relationship. If the acquiring provider has different processing facilities, you'll want the contract to account for revetting the new facility from a security perspective. Many companies like mine go through a very extensive vetting process from a security standpoint when we're having our data hosted by a third-party provider. And it's really important if your data is going to be moved to a different hosting facility that you have the ability to re-vet those security protocols. And you have the requirement for the new vendor to address and adhere to your security requirements in the event of a merger. Additionally, ensure your agreement provides for training of the new staff at the service provider on the established project protocols that you had in place with the old provider. Dira mentioned some provisions earlier about like key personnel clauses. So you could go to the extent of saying, hey, we've got this key person in this key role, and we need to ensure that in the event of a merger, that person's still going to stay on and manage our agreements. So you can have some of those types of things in your agreements. Make sure you can pull your work product and data out and get it moved to another provider at no cost. Both Dira and Dwayne mentioned the criticality of being able to get your data and your work product out without any cost to you. And ensure that your contract has an exit clause that's favorable to you, meaning you can exit that contract from that provider at any time for any reason without any penalty to you. Don't just assume that your contract has to perpetuate with the new provider and that you're stuck there. Make sure that whatever contract you have in place with the provider allows for you to exit at any point in time. And as far as providers radically switching platforms, this didn't happen in my particular scenario, but I know it has happened in the past. You'll want to make sure that your contract covers changes, number one, in pricing for the new platform, i.e. there shouldn't be any change in pricing to you. It shouldn't matter to you as the end client whether the provider is currently hosting Relativity and that's got one licensing model to them, and they switch to using Viewpoint that's got a different licensing model to them. You'll want to make sure that it's not a cost impact or cost differential to you, and if it is, you need to be able to have the ability to renegotiate that. And also, some platforms work very similarly, and it doesn't require a whole lot of retraining, but other platforms are radically different. So if the provider is changing platforms, you want to make sure that the provider is providing data conversion at no cost to you, that they are retraining all of the users in your engagement. That would be your internal staff, but all of your outside counsel and third-party experts and whoever else is working with your databases and your instances at that provider, that everybody gets retrained on how to use that new tool and that new technology.
You touched on something which is something that's really important to all of us, and that's relationships. Did the merger and acquisition have an effect on your firm's relationship with that vendor? And if so, what advice do you have for maintaining or adapting that relationship?
It absolutely had an effect on our company's relationship with the provider. I mentioned we went from being a large fish in a small pond to a medium-sized fish in the ocean. In some respects, it felt like the acquiring provider absolutely took for granted that our legacy relationship would perpetuate. And I've heard from others who have had those similar experiences where it's just kind of taken for granted that we would continue with the relationship with the new organization. Don't assume that the staff from the old provider is going to talk with the staff from the new provider to ensure continuity of your business relationship and your established processes. Also, don't assume that the leadership or business philosophy for the new provider is going to be the same as the old provider, even if your points of contact are telling you it's all rainbows and unicorns post-acquisition. You really need to take responsibility for establishing a new relationship with the leadership of the new provider. And my best advice is to establish, in terms of establishing that relationship, is to sit down and meet in person with the leadership of the new provider as soon as possible when there's that change of control. Even if the people you deal with every day are going to remain the same, you will want to establish a business relationship with the leadership of the new provider. In some respects, essentially the way you would vet a brand new relationship with a brand new provider. Sit down and talk about things like performance expectations. And that's been touched on earlier in this discussion. Talk about your expectations for communication protocols. Talk about what worked well and what wasn't working so well with the previous provider that you would want the new provider to take into consideration. Also, on a little bit more positive side, discuss what new technology might be available through the new provider that you would want to add to your workflow. The acquirer might have some new tool that the old provider didn't have that gives you enhanced capabilities for analytics or some other more advanced review capabilities. And maybe you want to talk about how to add that into your relationship. You want to do these things to ensure that the new relationship is getting off on the best foot. Even if you plan to switch new providers for new projects, or even if your primary points of contact are legacy staff from the old provider.
I would also add to that, from the managed services perspective, we've always still had odd jobs where we did contract with vendors to handle certain projects or certain pieces of certain projects. And I would add something that Deanna touched on, be sure to maintain relationships with other service providers in the industry. Don't assume that just because you have a relationship already with your managed services provider that they're going to give you the best service on an outsourced project or that they're going to give you the best price. Keep maintaining your contacts and your relationships with other vendors. And that way, if you do find yourself in a situation where you might want to jump ship, you have those contacts. You still have people to reach out to. They may aid in finding a new managed services partner for you, and they may give you better service. Just keep your eyes open and see what's out there. And then something else I think that Dira said that is really, really important takeaway from this discussion is that you should expect a turnover. Anticipate the organizational restructuring. It's coming down the road somewhere, sometime. So keep your eyes open and keep your contacts in place and never get comfortable and just assume that the way your business operates today is the way it's going to operate tomorrow.
Great. That leads right into the one of the last questions we have for the entire group. So feel free to chime in. What were your concerns? Did you have concerns about core talent loss from your provider? Dwayne, I'm going to start with you. How about you?
Okay. Yes, I think that's always, a big consideration and something to be, monitoring and watchful of is people that maybe you don't see all the time are in contact with, people other than your sales rep. But I think key architects, key consultants, also part of the development team. I think anytime you see some of, if you see changes, are people leaving in those positions, that can always be a big concern because obviously when companies acquire products, there's a number of reasons why the acquisition may have taken place. Depending on their strategy for the future of that product and what's going on, a lot of times the key people that are in the technical, that are involved in the technical side of the business, if they're not aligning with where the product's headed, generally, you're going to see them probably exit and leave, and that's a huge concern because if you're locked in with that product and you love the product and you really are wanting it to continue to survive, those people probably leaving might raise a concern of where that product's really headed in the future.
Dara, what is your thought on that?
Yeah, I agree with what Dwayne said, and it's because we all know that even though this is a technology business, it does all come down to the people at the end and how effective they are in doing their roles. And I always worry about the people I can see, but more importantly, the people I can't see that might play an instrumental role in delivering the level or quality of service that I need in anything, whether it's a product and we're talking about engineers or coders, or whether it's a managed services agreement. But to some extent, you can mitigate the loss of talent by having good documentation and good procedures. So there are some things I can do to protect myself and my clients against loss of personnel, but I always make sure that I have the documentation, that I have all the latest release notes, that I have plans, if there's technology, that I have the user manuals and user guides. And for the managed services agreements or vendors that I use, I make sure that there are good processes in place that are documented, so that if there is turnover, let's say in project managers, there's at least a resource that everybody can go to bring new personnel up to speed or a different team up to speed?
Well, great. In summary, I'm going to ask each of the panelists to give their number one takeaway from their experience in the M&A in the e-discovery market. Let's go ahead and start with Deanna.
My number one takeaway is assume a merger or acquisition is going to take place potentially with every provider you're working with. And make sure that you address the things that we've discussed in this discussion today going into every relationship. I don't want that to sound like, you know, I'm saying the sky is falling, but we have so much change in our industry and there are so many acquisitions and mergers happening just all the time that you've got to come from a position of strength, and that position of strength starts with assuming one is going to happen, and that, and then you can build in the provisions before you go into the business relationship with any provider.
Bonnie?
My number one is get it in writing. You can't have too much writing. I would prefer to see my contract be 500 pages long and be sure that I've outlined every single expectation that I have of my vendor than to assume anything. Your contract is your lifeboat. So you want to make sure that you've dotted all your I's and crossed all your T's. And if there's anything that you expect or want or need of your vendor and that relationship with that vendor, be sure to put it in your contract.
Dara, how about you?
So building on what's been said, have a plan. And talk through that plan and work through that plan. So even talking about it internally or with your vendors puts you ahead. If you don't take the next step and actually get everything in your contract, at least talking through the various scenarios will help you in no small measure if the circumstance does arise that one of your vendors is acquired. And talking it through might also give you more intelligence, particularly if you're talking this through with your vendors about things that might actually be about to happen.
And Dwayne?
Yeah, I think to go along with what everyone else said, that you definitely need to have a contingency plan and a migration plan in place. It's just something that even just as for backup. And the only other thing I would add is really take a look at your software. You know, stay away from the long-term software arrangements, because I just think that puts you in a position where you don't have as much leverage on getting out. You need to try to make sure that you allow yourself the ability to evaluate your products regularly and not be locked into a long-term engagement.
Excellent. Thank you so much, everyone, for participating today. And this is a very important and topical topic, and we appreciate you attending. Thank you.
You've been listening to ILTA Radio. Subscribe to ILTA's podcasts through iTunes or Podbean and get alerted about new recordings. ILTA Radio, get tuned in.